trying to figure out to what extent, if at all, we are supposed to be reading the Old Testament stories as historical facts, like literal stories, as opposed to something less than that, maybe like literary art or metaphors or something like that. You know, these stories, are we supposed to understand them as something that really occurred in history, and does it matter?
Welcome back to the Rheology Podcast. Rheology is a nonprofit ministry that is centered around rethinking, researching, and rediscovering, a process that dives deep into the depths of an intimate partnership with God through a concept Jesus initiated called ecclesia. We strive to cultivate an environment that is not only safe to question and seek, but also one that is founded on the truths of partnership, words of hope that were uttered from the lips of Jesus himself. So in this podcast, we'll question Christian tradition, we'll investigate God myths, and we'll listen to those who are stirring, questioning, and desperately seeking more of what God is doing in and around us each day.
Hey everybody, this is Scott Johnson with Rheology, and of course, this is the Rheology Podcast. And so that dude over there, that's Brandon.
Hey everyone. Glad to be back.
And today we're going to do some more God talk while we drink coffee. And today, hey, what do you got over there, Brandon? By the way, what coffee are you drinking? Are you drinking coffee?
Back to black coffee today.
Back to black. Is it from the same joint?
Yeah.
Back in black. Oh, nice. Any clue where that coffee comes from? Probably no. Don't care.
No, I have no idea. And don't care.
No, Dad. Don't care. Well, I'm drinking, this is, if you can see, this is called Rex Coffee. This is my buddy Jason, who has been listening to and watches the podcast for a long, long time. Rex Coffee is his favorite coffee. May not be his favorite coffee after here soon, because I sent him Kicking Horse, which is like my all-time favorite.
Yeah.
This is Rex Coffee, and of course, it's decaf. And I'm drinking it out of, I'm going to be as super careful as I possibly. This is what's called an ember mug.
Oh, I've seen those. Yeah.
Heard of an ember mug?
Keeps
this
it warm.
This is actually,
right?
Robin's. Yeah, it keeps it warm. It's got a battery in it, a little heater in it. It's, you can use your Bluetooth connect to it with your phone.
Serves as
it
a speaker.
It drinks itself. It's beautiful. Yes, no doubt. So, nice. We'll see. I've only used it one time, and it and actually does definitely keep the coffee warm.
Yeah, mine's already cold. So.
Hold on.
Yeah, oh, I'm jealous.
There you go. Yeah, she got it as a gift. So, yeah, I typically drink my coffee so fast it doesn't have a chance to get cold. But anyhow, All right, what we got going on today?
Well, today, next up in our list of questions, I wonder if we'll ever run out of these questions. Probably not.
Probably not.
They just keep coming as I dig deeper and deeper. But question of today has to do with the Old Testament in particular. I was reading, going back through Genesis for like the sixth time in the last year, trying to figure out to what extent, if at all, we are supposed to be reading the Old Testament stories as historical facts, like literal stories, as opposed to something less than that, maybe like literary art or metaphors or something like that. I know we've talked about that briefly on other episodes, but that's the question is, you know, these stories, are we supposed to understand them as something that really occurred in history? And does it matter if we understand them that way or not? Or are we supposed to be reading them with a different mindset? So,
yeah, that's a good one. I think the big thing that the big main reason that most people come to this conclusion or this question, this point of questioning, is because there are so many stories wrapped into the Old Testament that we have a hard time, like, well, honestly, believing, right? Because there's some crazy stuff going on in there.
Yeah, no
kidding. And especially in a culture where they, in a time where they did things that seem incredibly archaic and maybe even, you know, borderline barbaric. It's almost like, you know, a Game of Thrones episode more than it is like actually historically accurate. And so because we live in a very modern age, you know, it's very hard for us to really kind of go, you know, what's going on here? And is this really, I mean, how serious should I take this?
Yeah.
You know, so I think historical typically like equals true.
Right. Right. Like, yeah, I think that's the problem. That's the problem I've struggled with in my entire Christian faith. It's like, and I'm starting to come off of it, luckily, but, you know, for decades at this point, I've struggled with, if I can't take this as historically accurate, then what can I trust in the Bible? But now as I dig in even deeper, I'm starting to learn that the historicity of these things really has little to no bearing on the truth claims that they're making.
Yep.
And so starting to shift my mind on it.
Yeah. And that is like the crux of it, because I think you're right on it right there, that most people look at it and say, if this isn't like 100% historically accurate and pinpoint, then, you know, it starts to shake our faith in it being true. And because that's the way we do think as Westerners. And we'll get to that here in a second. Let's talk about like historical, because I think a lot of people think of these stories as, you know, I think a lot of people in the world think of these stories as just made up story tales and folklore, legend kind of stuff. Christians may not, but then again, some Christians just accept it wholeheartedly and they don't even question it. And they go, that sounds weird, I'll just move on. And they don't even spend any time like really digging into it.
Yeah.
So you have like those two extremes. It's not true at all. It sounds stupid. It's made up, whatever. And then you have the Christians go, no, it's absolutely true. I'm not sure how. And I haven't really read too much about it. And I really don't care about all the genealogy. And I skip through a big chunk of it anyway to get to the main Sunday school stories, you know, like, you know, Jonah and Abraham and Moses and Daniel and all that stuff. So, you know, so as far as like historically accurate, you know, I am obviously, I'm not an expert when it comes to, you know, biblical history or biblical archaeology. Or anything like that. But I do know that there have been, and again, I'll just mention like two very briefly because I don't know that much about them. But there are a lot of like very smart people who do, and they spend their lives doing this. And I think for our culture, there's like, unfortunately, there's like a moment that we have to like accept before we can go really any further. So, and this is typically it, you know, okay, you know, like, you know, did the flood really happen or is this a story? Because if it's just a story, it may kind of shake everything else down the line for me.
Yeah.
But let's, you know, let me figure out if this is like historically, if these stories or mainly the history of the Hebrew people, which would be, you know, Father Abraham all the way down to, you know, Joseph or whatever, and then the prophets, like, are they true? Let's just, you know, that, just give me that, and I'll probably be okay. So there's a couple things that I think are really cool. There's a pharaoh in Egypt. His name is Merneptah, and he reigned as pharaoh after Ramses II. Ramses II was like one of the most popular pharaohs. So there was this thing called a stela, and I don't mean, you know, the famous movie quote stela, and I'm not gonna do it either, and I'm sure you're glad I'm not gonna do it. Yeah. So there is a thing called a stela, and for us, when we as people who read the Bible, there's some like cousins of a stela that we know of, like for instance, a monument that someone has set up, like an altar of rocks or something. They would also put up these things called Ebenezers, and those are just monument stones, and they would be dedicated to the memory of something important that happened. A stela is like a monument stone, and they're typically, you know, right around 10 feet tall. They're made of like granite, and they have a story etched on the outside of these stones. And primarily the stories are bragging, you know, it's a king or a ruler, a pharaoh at this point, whatever, is bragging about a battle and winning a battle and defeating and destroying their enemy. And so there was for Merneptah, the pharaoh, there was a back in the 19th century, they uncovered a stela that was his, and it just bragged about, you know, all the things that he had accomplished. And down towards the bottom of the stone, there actually is a mention of a nation called Israel that he had destroyed and conquered. And, you know, what kind of destruction or conquering did that mean? Probably nothing. They were already living in Egypt.
Yeah.
But it's probably a memorial that he actually kind of enslaved them and used them as manual labor and didn't actually destroy them or conquer them. But those are kind of like poetic words kings would use to embellish, you know, being a ruler over people. But
yeah.
But so Israel is there. So like, you know, historically, you know, OK, like that's like something we can hang our hat on. There's another stela that was called the Tel Dan inscription, and it is a stela of a king. It was found in the northern regions of Galilee in this area called Tel Dan, and it's a king of Hazael of Damascus or that area. And this is something that is recorded in 2 Kings 8, where, you know, Israel as a nation has been split into two different nations. And Hazael of Damascus actually defeats Jehoram of Israel and Ahaz of Judah. I'm butchering Ahaz's name, but 2 Kings 8. So basically they found a stela, and this is actually, they found the stela, I believe, in like the early 90s or something like that. And once again, here's a historical piece that actually mentions the house of David, which would be, you know, Israel. So even though he defeated both kings in a single battle, but the quote is, you know, the house of David. So this is like one of the first real, because like a lot of time, I mean, some people just had a hard time believing that David was a real king.
Right.
You know, so even though in Jerusalem, you can go and dig down, you can see a lot of different, you know, the city was built upon an old city, mm-hmm. and that old city was built upon. So there's layers of cities. But historically, how does the Bible match up with other history, right? The Egyptian history, other history of other nations around it. And so this is one of those things. Again, a very, very brief, you know, a couple, just two small little pieces to help our minds go, okay, there have been artifacts that have been found that do link with what we read in the Bible as far as history goes with you know, real history in surrounding areas. So at least we can hang our hat on that and go, okay, as far as like, historically accurate, we can at the very least connect the dots between history that we wholeheartedly accept, right? The history of the Egyptians, the history of Babylon or other mm-hmm. other, you know, kingdoms in that area. And so we have these two stelas as just two small examples of those worlds connecting with the Bible, the biblical world. So at the very least, we can say, okay, cool. That's we take that and get it out of the way. And of course, another question then would be like, okay, but like, so, okay, we accept that, you know, that historically they do fit. They were real people. Cool. We'll give it that. But what about like all the, you know, the stories?
Yeah.
And specifically, you know, the probably the first five books of the Torah, maybe a couple of the history books, like, you know, Chronicles and Kings.
Yeah.
Because Chronicles and Kings are historical actual accounts.
Right.
So how are we supposed to take those? And that's where, you know, that's where we really start to then like have to like shift into the world of Americans in the 21st century.
Yeah.
In a modern age, trying to look at the same thing that other people lived with or looked at, you know, thousands of years ago.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things I'm starting to learn is just how different ancient authors wrote than what we're used to with our Western mindset. I think I read somewhere, somebody said that the Western mind can't comprehend that traditional, like, prose narrative, like we see in the Old Testament, could also be a literary art. Usually when we read prose narrative, we're reading it for the truth of what's being said. But I can't remember who noted this, but they were saying that ancient Israelites or the biblical authors would write in prose narrative, but they would do so as literary art. They would use that style to and be artistic in it, including in things like genealogies, which just blows my mind. I mean, how could, you know, thinking, you know, from our perspective, it's like, how could there be any art form to a genealogy? But this author looked at things like, I can't remember, I think it's in Genesis somewhere, but looking at the genealogies and how the ages that certain folks live to, and there's one guy smack in the middle that lived 365 days according to the, or 365 years, sorry, according to the genealogy. And the author of this book I was reading was talking about how that's almost certainly literary art used to almost like a parody to make fun of other ancient writings that would have placed that person in the middle and would have talked about him being like the sun god. In other words, it was so unlikely that he actually lived 365 days, given its relationship to our solar year, that it's more likely it was being used as some kind of a parody. It's like, you know, originally I would have looked at that and said, you know, if we can't even trust the genealogies in these things, and what can we trust in it? But the more I'm reading it, it's like, okay, I could still take something from this, even if it's, because we're not really looking at it for the length of time that people lived. I mean, that's not the purpose of what's being conveyed there anyway. So,
no, yeah, it's not like, hey, you won't believe this, but this guy lived 365 years. Seriously, he really did.
Yeah.
That's not really, I think, like, for instance, I have, you may have heard this as well, but I've heard so many people talk about the word Leviathan, which is, it's just found in Job. And people would look at Leviathan and go, look, see, dinosaurs existed, you know, back with, you know, in 3000 BC or whatever, 4000 BC. And completely don't look the rest of the context. I mean, if you read the book of Job, it is primarily incredibly poetic.
Yeah.
And it is not written, it does not read like, you know, a biography.
Yeah.
It does not read like an actual, like a census or a historical account. You know, then Job went and did this and he said this, and I quote, well, no. And Leviathan there in that context is literally the same kind of thing you just said. It's almost like they took like the beliefs of the people, of other people around them, and would say like, yeah, you know, God's even the God of Bigfoot, kind of a mentality. Yeah,
right.
You know, here's, you know, I've mentioned to you because, because we are looking at this document and these people and this time and this culture through a very, 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 very different lens. You know, historically accurate or is kind of a as N.T. Wright would always say, you know, that's really the wrong question to be asking.
Yeah.
It is historical and it is history. But again, like you said, it's not, and pointed out, it's not really written to do that. It's, except some pieces are, but overall it's not. I've told you about BEMA, which is a podcast by a guy named Marty Solomon, who has studied the Old Testament. He's apprenticed under like a couple of rabbis, and he's also apprenticed underneath one of the biggest scholars in the world when it comes to that culture and that time and those people. He has a podcast called BEMA. It's been going on for quite a while, and it is intense. I've told you before, it is literally like taking you know, a major theological biblical deep dive, almost like a class, you know, like a very intense class on the Bible. And he literally goes like chapter to chapter to chapter. It's not, I mean, he goes, starts at the beginning and goes, but in his intro, he says this, I'll quote him. He says, "Most Christians in our culture are Greek," and he means Western, "who think about the world in a much different way than the people of the Bible. As a result, much of the Bible is lost on our culture, and lost even more as we try to explain it through a Western lens. If you learn to think Hebrew, the text will begin to come alive." And he has some examples of like the way that our culture sees certain things and their culture would see things. And he talks about words as just a base, a foundation.
Yeah.
He says that the Greek culture, or the Western culture, which is where our culture comes from, words are used to express truth and ideas and definitions. And then for a Hebrew or an Eastern culture, words are used to express truth using pictures and stories instead of ideas and definitions. And he talks about, you know, the Greek or Western mindset prefers like prose and outlines and lists and bullet points, right? And then the Eastern prefers like poetry and imagery and symbolism. And he talks about like, you know, numbers, for instance, and we see numbers as quantity. That's how many, 12 apples. Okay, you bought 12 actual apples from the store. And the Eastern culture would have seen it as quality or symbol. You know, they're symbolic. And I think, you know, the big thing and takeaway is to be able to like study specifically the Old Testament in a certain way that will, honestly, it will help the Old Testament come alive, or the New Testament come alive, in like, you know, bigger than ever, because then you'll understand why Jesus said some of the things he said, because you understand the context of a Hebrew people.
I heard an analogy that I think emphasizes your point, which is that, you know, if we're looking at a painting like Van Gogh's Starry Night today, we wouldn't necessarily say that's not a depiction of reality. We would just say it's a depiction, it's an artistic expression of what a starry night looks like. And it's helpful, I think, to view some of the stories in the Old Testament the same way. We still derive truth from them, even if the way in which they are communicating truth is more artistic than just a historical account of what actually happened.
Yes, totally. And I think we can start off with Genesis in that mindset, because we do start off with Genesis with a statement, you know, that God created the heavens and the earth. That's a statement right off the bat. Let me just go ahead and tell you that he created it. Nobody else. He did. And then what we have an account after that, unfortunately for Americans, we have, you know, we have a bullet point list, right? Seven bullet points.
Yeah.
Day one, day two, day three, day four, day five. And unfortunately, right off the bat, for Americans, our mindset goes, "Oh, we got bullet points here."
Yeah.
Because we're gonna have some short facts.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's not necessarily.
Yeah. Because then with that mindset, you immediately run into problems, right? Because like you see in the creation story, on one of the days, God creates humanity, but then just a chapter later, it's like he's creating Adam and Eve as if they are the first human beings again. So it's like, what are we doing right here? This has already happened on in the creation yeah story. So
right.
Yeah. So
yeah. It's like, what are we retelling this?
Right.
Or so it's, you know, as you and I have kind of talked a little bit, it is that in our mind, immediately we look at this as a historical account, mm-hmm, right? It's Genesis. This is how the world was made. And granted, the writer is kind of giving some detail, but yeah, it's not detail in the mindset of, I need to write this down as an account for everybody, you know, to always remember exactly how God did it.
Yeah.
Because the reality is like, how would the writer know?
Right.
How God exactly did it. They weren't there. It didn't go, oh, okay, then he did that and he's taking notes the whole time you watched him. No. So what you come to find out if you start to study Genesis is you start to really understand that Genesis is actually more of a gospel than it is a historical account. And it's primarily meant for the Chaldean area. I think you and I have been talked about that before. The Chaldean area, which is over by, you know, where the Tigris and Euphrates are, which is kind of like modern day Iraq, Iran area. Mm-hmm. And this is where Abram came from. This is where, honestly, this is where civilization started. Yeah. You know, the garden is meant to be somewhere in that location or incorporate that location at the very least, right? So this is really a almost like a gospel to be sent back to people of that culture to let them know that, like, you know, first and foremost, you guys serve all these gods. Actually, there's only one God.
Yeah.
And you think this God and that God and that God, this one God created this and that God created that and that God created that. No, there's only one God and he created all of it.
Yeah.
And it's really more along the lines of a, you know, it's a gospel, like a sermon, almost a letter to say, let me tell you about, you know, the real God here.
Another helpful analogy that I think I've heard is that it's more helpful to view the Old Testament as more of a cookbook. We want it to be a science book with explanations for the physics of how the universe came to be. But if we view it more like a cookbook, which is what are we to do with the ingredients that we've been dealt, as opposed to an explanation of how the food came to be in the first place. It exists to tell a story of how we got ourselves into the position we're in right now in our relationship with God. And here's a bunch of different ways, because we see this in the patterns in the Old Testament. I didn't realize this until fairly recently, that all of these stories in the Old Testament are following essentially the same pattern over and over again. They're different stories in different contexts, but they're ultimately mm-hmm aimed at telling us the same thing. God, you know, this tension between God's judgment and his mercy and our role in that whole story, and how we ultimately exposing how we need somebody like Jesus to come in and show us how it is that we are supposed to be doing this thing.
Totally. And, you know, we can get in, because we can get into that on the next episode that we do. But that is, you know, spoiler alert, that's kind of where, yes, this is all going. And once you see it as a, you know, as we said, a narrative, right, that these two things belong together, that the Old Testament is really just context for the culmination, and the culmination is Jesus.
I think Jesus says that himself, that he is,
sure, absolutely,
that the Old Testament points to him.
Yeah, absolutely. When he says, I come to fulfill the law, mm-hmm, you know, he's not necessarily saying, like, you know, that we got a contract and then the last clause says to be determined. And, you know, he's the to be determined factor. It's more along the lines of the complete narrative of the story. Where is this going and how does it culminate? And he's the apex, he's the culmination of all of that. And so therefore, you know, being, and man, you know, it's not easy to sit here and go, all right, I'm gonna look at it from a West and Eastern, you know, mindset. I'll put on my Hebrew glasses and I'll look at it from a Hebrew. We're not Hebrew. We don't live over there. we didn't, you know, we drive around in electric cars, for crying out loud. You know, there are some things that they would have done on an everyday basis that seem incredibly odd and weird and archaic and unbelievable. But to them, it was real life. And so yeah. It's not easy.
And I think adding to the complexity is that we have Christians, in particular, certain types of traditions of Christian faith, and then also scholars that have different takes on this. Some of them, including well-known scholars, believe these stories to be literal, and others don't. So it's like we don't even have agreement among scholars on this stuff, which makes it particularly difficult.
It does. I think the cool thing is though, like, you know, now compared to like the, you know, I'm going to age myself here, but like the 80s or the, yeah. or even the 90s, right? We still, like, as we kind of talked about in the last couple episodes, we still wholeheartedly believed, like everybody wholeheartedly believed all the way down the line that there was a second coming that incorporated taking a few people and leaving others behind, and mm-hmm. then a third coming to get them, and then you know, a heaven and a hell and a great judgment and people sent to, I mean, you know, in just a few decades ago, everybody was pretty much all on the same yeah. table, right?
Yeah, I remember growing now, up in that tradition.
Yep.
Yes. Essentially fundamentalist type
right.
mindset. Yeah.
Right. Yes. And I think I grew up, you know, in a youth group where we did these things called Journey Through Hell. And it was an event. They were super fun.
Sounds like it.
It was a blast. Hey, what'd you do on your Saturday night? I went to hell. Cool. And they were really kind of like a scare tactic almost of mm-hmm. like, see how bad hell is? You don't want to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah, now we have, you know, some really good scholars who are not only talking about this and teaching this, but like they're teaching it on like a broadband spectrum, right? On social media or on YouTube or podcasts or whatever. And like what we're doing right now, you know, is like that may not be true. And some of the things that we thought we had a really, really, really good grip on, you know, probably not true. So it's, yeah. So I see like the debate kind of mentality as a good thing.
Yeah.
Not that we hold debates just for the sake of holding debates for, you know, kicks and giggles or whatever, but we're debating because we're really trying to like dig through it. Yeah. Right. And we're really trying to like figure it out. And I think, I think the biggest thing that took place is when, you know, Western scholars started actually going to like Eastern culture and asking them, you know, yeah. who have studied this and lived this for, you know, decades and centuries,
yeah.
you know, tell me about how you guys approach it. And right. that's really where it kind of opened up a lot of people's minds to go, wow, okay, I have been looking at this from like this event happened, you know, in America and, you know, in the West, in the middle 1800s or something. Yeah. And no, you know, yeah. no, not at all.
Yeah. I think it's, looking back on it now from, my old mindset to where I am today. And I've only been on this, what I would call like a stirring journey, as we call it, for, mm-hmm. you know, just over a year. But even looking back at it then, I would have thought some of the conversations that I'm having now with you and some of the things I'm learning from others as being almost like heretical. Like the things that I'm hearing now seem completely at odds with what I've learned my entire life. But, and I mean, you'll see that in all kinds of comments to our videos and to videos like ours. And I just want to say, I mean, the more I dig into it and start to sit with these ideas, it's almost like freeing because it's showing mm-hmm. me how much I've been missing by taking such a rigid view of these stories. I've been in that mindset for 30 plus years, and just over the past year where I've started to open up and starting to embrace these other understandings of the text, it's just like opened my mind exponentially to what I think God is trying to tell us through these stories. I would have missed it completely if I would have just stuck on that same trajectory. So
I wholeheartedly agree with that. And I think for different reasons, but I really believe that we become rigid because we're fearful that if we question it, it's like it means that God does not exist.
Yeah, right.
And we fight tooth and nail to, you know, prove that he exists, you know. And the thing is like, you don't, it's not really your job. Your job is not really to sit and try to prove that he exists. And I think for some people, you know, to allow that rigid exterior to melt away, it's almost like saying, you know, I've been defeated by Satan almost, right? The devil's won here. And, you know, I just go back to, you know, Jeremiah. And, you know, God, as we've said this before in this podcast, but, you know, God going to Jeremiah and saying, hey, I want you to go somewhere. I'll show you where I want you to go. But this is a message I want you to be able to relay to the people of Israel, the Hebrew people. And he guides Jeremiah through the city, and he goes to this potter's house, and he looks this potter's practice or whatever. Anyway, and he sees this potter is taking this clay and he's molding it into something, and then the potter tears it down and starts molding the clay into something else. And he says, and God says, this is what I want to do. This is how I want to be the potter, and I want Israel, I want Hebrew people, I want them to be the clay. And the lesson there is like, don't, you're not fired yet. You're not made of stone yet. You should be pliable and you should be moldable. And another thing too, that we see all throughout the Old Testament is, you know, God is wanting his people to be, you know, nomads. He wants them to be nomads. Robin has been doing a Bible through the year thing in an NIV study Bible. And she's like, man, they just like, I go from this town to that town. They go to this town to that. They're just like always on the move. And I'm like, that was the point.
Yeah,
because Jesus talks about him being the shepherd. Well, God—that's what God ultimately wants to be—is be our shepherd, and the shepherd leads us. And you know, civilization always wants to get to the city,
yeah,
right, and build cities because then they can be self-sufficient and self-sustainable. Yeah. And God's people were meant to be nomads, and that's why when he gave them his presence, he put it in a tabernacle, a mobile home. It can be torn down and be on the move. And it's just the idea of being flexible and always being a disciple ready to learn instead of being like, I got it all figured out. And if it can't, you know, I can't waver, because if I waver, that starts, you know, to look like God's not real.
Yeah. I think that's one of the major themes I've learned over the past year and kind of exploring this stuff and taking new mindsets is this, and I think this is ultimately the theme of the Bible. If you could sum it up, it's trying to get to a place where we are not reliant on ourselves and being comfortable with ourselves being in control and putting that reliance in God. I mean, that goes back to the Garden of Eden. I mean, that was the fall, right? It's the hubris to think that we are God ourselves rather than images of God.
Absolutely.
And we need to relinquish our own control and rely on him. We then see that in with Israel being in the wilderness for 40 years, completely reliant on God during that entire time. And so I think that's the story that, or the truth that we are meant to take from it all.
It is. And as we'll talk about in the next episode, that is, you know, that is absolutely the narrative. That is God's ultimate desire. When people talk about, you know, God's will, God's will, God's will, that is it. Ultimately, that is God's will, is for, you know, heaven and earth to coexist together, as we talked about. That's what the ecclesia is. You know, as you have two pieces come together and they play their roles, and when they play their roles, it's a beautiful thing. But the Old Testament, I used to see it as like the Old Testament, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we don't need the Old Testament because we'll get the new. That was the old plan. This is the new plan. And what I learned a couple of years ago is that most Old Testament experts don't call it the Old Testament. They call it the First Testament. And that puts things into perspective.
Yeah.
It did happen in an older time, in a different place, different people. But it doesn't mean it's not true. And there's a lot of lessons that we can glean from just kind of going a little deeper into the Old Testament if we'll, kind of look at it from a different, perspective.
From the whole Rheology team, we hope these podcasts are encouraging and educational. Rheology exists for three main reasons: to reach, train, and equip those who want to go deeper with God in this partnership called Ecclesia. If God has been stirring in your heart, where you are wondering if there's more than what you've been experiencing in today's 21st century Christianity, we'd love to connect with you, to hear your story and help you know that you are not alone. You can simply contact us via the website, rheologylife.com, or reach out via Instagram at @rheology_life. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.